Welcome to Mission Promise, Navigating Special Education for Military Families. I'm your host, Mary, and a fellow military spouse. I'm so excited to be here with you, sharing stories, insights, and resources that can help military families like ours navigate the world of special education. So let's dive in. Welcome back to another episode with Mission Promise. Today, we have Grace Kim. She is the founder and president of the Executive Board for Partners in Promise, and she's the principal attorney with the Law Office of Grace E. Kim, PC, where the focus is special education and educational law. So thank you, Grace, for coming on today and spending some time with us. Can you introduce yourself a little bit more to our listeners?
You did a really good job, Mary.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Grace. And one of the reasons why I joined with the executive director, Michelle Norman, to found the Partners in Promise is that we both have experienced some significant challenges with educating our children while being in the military, as well as having kids with differences, with special needs. My son Josiah is autistic, and he's also has some physical disabilities, as well as a condition called persistent hyperplastic primary vitreous, which is very rare. And it's kind of a secondary sign that something occurred during the development process. So from get-go, from jump, when Josiah made his way into the world, we knew he was going to be different. And he's been such a joy to raise, but he's also the reason why I'm a special education attorney. And Partners in Promise has been so important for families like ours because, you know, we're able to get some resources, feel that we're not alone by listening to the stories of so many others, even your own story, Mary. And we've just been so inspired and hope to continue to make some real change for our families with military families with special needs kiddos. I mean, my kid's not a kid anymore. He's 22, so he's an adult. So we're in that transition.
Nice. That's awesome. Today, we will talk about IEPs and the importance of data collection. Grace, why would you say data collection is important?
It's everything. I mean, we are all about data. Without the data, it's impossible to really know whether or not all of the accommodations and services and IEP goals that are being put in place are effective, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't want to waste our time or our kiddos' educational time, which is very precious, if it's not going to lead to greater independence or a future, right? When you're considering whether your child is a student who requires special education services and related services, you go through a process typically where which involves usually some evaluations, psychological, educational. In the case of, you know, my son, it was psychological, educational testing, or what can also be referred to as neuropsychological testing, speech and language evaluations, occupational therapy evaluations, physical therapy evaluations, functional vision assessments, lots of different evaluations being done. And that's in addition to those, you know, benchmark sorts of developmental milestones when they're little infants and toddlers, and then educational or grade level milestones when they enter K through 12. Mm-hmm. And when you take a look at a child in relation to all of that information, that's when we can identify what their needs according to their disabilities are and come up with a plan as to how to address them. But, you know, this is not an exact science. There's a lot of, you know, trial and error involved. And, you know, for some children on the autism spectrum, for example, applied behavior analysis is very important and incredibly, you know, life-changing. For Josiah Kim, it really, he could take it or leave it. And the only way we discovered that was by identifying the need, the behavioral challenges that he had, coming up with a plan, and then taking data on whether or not the interventions we were implementing were making any difference at all. Now, fast forward to when a child is grade level. Let's just talk elementary school. I'm sure you and many of our listeners have heard things like, you know, boys develop slower than girls, or catch up eventually. Yeah, reading is like all around us, and language and this, that, and the other. The problem is when your child is neurodivergent, has neurobiological differences for those kiddos who are dyslexic and have other learning disabilities. It's not enough just to place them in what many people refer to as a language-rich environment, as if we're just going to learn to read by osmosis. You know, that doesn't always happen. You know, if you stick with someone like you or me, if we, you know, I don't know about your background, but I don't have any of the same level of neurodivergence as my son. There's no way I was going to like not learn, right? You stick me in a classroom, I was going to learn to read, even if you never taught me directly. Shoot, when I started school in the United States, I didn't even speak English, right? And I was able to learn language. Well, if you did the same thing with a student who, you know, has dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, or any other challenges, ADHD, autism, etc., you stick them in a classroom, you can't expect them to learn the same way. Right.
Yeah.
And when you have data that shows this kid is not learning, that's what we use whenever we hear those terms, oh, boys just learn slower or they'll pick it up eventually. You bring that data and you say, it's been, I don't know, 3-4 years. And the actual level of progress has only moved from like pre-primer to primer. And the kids are now in third grade. Right. And third grade is that kind of like demarcation. You got kindergarten, first, second. They're learning their ABCs and their 1-2-3s. And then third grade hits and they're now expected to be able to read a little more independently, you know, chapter books, things like that. They're expected to be able to write in full sentences. Well, you know, when you have a child who has dyslexia and dysgraphia, that's not going to happen. And that's where that data is so important. Whenever you go to an IEP meeting, let's say you and I know, hey, the student is going to need a lot of support and direct instruction in math, in calculation. And they say, well, that's your opinion, but we think as long as he keeps attending, he'll be fine. Well, no, that's when you say, here's the data. Or you tell them, okay, if you think that little Johnny's going to be fine, please show me the data that he's actually making progress, right? Yeah. I mean, what is the point of an education if we're not progressing from grade to grade? Yes, but also progressing in skill. Because you have grade level requirements, which are applicable to all students, but then you have the specialized instruction for children with individualized education plans, who, you know, with that specialized instruction are supposed to make specific progress in their areas of need towards certain skills that are going to allow them to access the general education curriculum.
Right. That's good information. And I love how you broke it down. So what would you say are the legal requirements for data collection in the context of an IEP?
Yeah, and that's a great question because oftentimes we as parents are uninformed. I mean, I don't know about you, Mary, but prior to becoming a lawyer, I had, you know, a bachelor's degree. I had a master's degree. You know, it wasn't like I was some slouch who doesn't, you know, better herself through reading lots and lots of books. But I didn't know what the language of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act said about data collection. I don't know what it said about the requirements. I mean, at a minimum, the IEP should contain a present level of academic achievement and functional performance. Some people like call that the PLAF, but you'll often hear it being called the PLOP. PLOP. It's shortened for present levels of performance. And those people I'm talking about are our IEP teams and teachers, et cetera. The IEP has to include a statement of where the student is currently functioning, both academically and functionally. So academically, that's reading, writing, and math, as well as, you know, science and social studies, you know, your core kind of curriculum. And the functional performance, that's what sometimes is called the hidden curriculum, which thankfully nowadays is no longer hidden, but being brought to the forefront. The functional performance looks at social functioning, emotional functioning, or regulatory functioning, executive functioning, how well a student is able to organize thoughts and belongings, et cetera. And so both of those, academic and functional, are a part of what needs to be reported on in an IEP PLOP or PLAF. And this requires data collection. If you ever open your IEP or your child's IEP and it says something like, the teacher thinks like little Susie's amazing and she smiles all the time and she's a ray of sunshine, be like, stop. So please explain, what is the data to support that my daughter is amazing, right? What's the data to support that she smiles all the time? What's the data to support that she's a little ray of sunshine? This document is not meant to just kind of be a general, you know, this kid's great or this kid's not so great. It's supposed to look specifically at those areas of academic performance, reading, writing, math, science and social studies, as well as functional performance, social, emotional, executive functioning, et cetera. That data can be collected in a very sort of general fashion, and case law has said that as long as, you know, there's some observable data, it's okay. But what's best is to ensure that if there are areas of need, now strengths, of course, we need to recognize all of our kiddos' strengths, but the IEP is not so much about the strengths as it is about the needs. Okay, let's be clear. We're not trying to be down on our kids, but we're trying to be honest and to look at the situation objectively. What are these children's needs according to those disabilities? And how do we collect data towards progress in those areas? Well, after you have a PLOP or PLOP, you then write measurable annual goals. And that measurability is where you get the data. All right. So I was in an IEP meeting yesterday, Mary. It was Virginia Beach City Public Schools. I had an IEP meeting where I was representing a family there. And the IEP for this child said, given a list of 10 words, he will read 10 words.
What?
With 70% accuracy over a 9-week period. And I was floored. Like, so this is what 10 words? And he'll, over 9 weeks, he's just reading the same 10 words?
10 words. Wow.
But at 70% accuracy. So what does that mean? He'll accurately read 70% of each word, or he'll accurately read 70% of the 10 words. So we're actually just measuring 7 out of 10 words. What is happening? That's just an example. Now, to be fair to the to Virginia Beach City Public Schools. So to be fair to Virginia Beach City Public Schools, that was at one school. That student transferred to another school, and the new school took one look at these goals and rewrote them all. So kid will read 10 words became, the student will be able to decode single and multisyllabic words, including these different phonemes, with the 70%. And it was not over a 9-week period, but it was 70% to be measured biweekly, every 2 weeks, rather than every once every, because 9-week period means like once every 9 weeks, you're going to check this.
Right.
So the IEP goal was supposedly targeting the same thing, which is I hope they were trying to talk about decoding. But even within the same school district, one IEP team was like, 10 words, you're going to read it. I don't know how or how many really, but this is your goal. High five. And you know they're not really tracking any data. How could you? Right?
Right.
But school within the same school district, of course, was able to really fashion that goal to address the areas of deficit that had been identified by the recent evaluations, the recent benchmark assessments that have been done. And that's what we mean by measurable. Okay, so the other goal, the example, clearly, I don't know what I'm measuring, don't know where the list comes from, don't know what's 70%. The new goal is very specific. Here are the phonemes we're looking at. We're going to put them in words of single or multi-syllable words. And there were objectives under the goal that had single syllable, and then it had multi-syllabic. So they were tracking both. And the list of words were known. Like, it wasn't just like a mystery list out there that somebody was just coming up with, but it was a part of this educational program that the school team had proposed to use. And that's measurable. Right? You know where the words are coming from. You know exactly what we're decoding. We're looking at single syllable, multi-syllable. Wonderful. That data has to be taken at the, well, as I was talking, there had been already what we call baseline data to show, all right, this is where the kid is functioning now. We're looking at a year from now, where does he need to be? And with that baseline data, that's when you're taking data to make sure that he's actually progressing. And if he's not, if it ends up in, you know, a few weeks' time, in a month's time, that he's actually below benchmark, uh-oh, that's when the IEP team has to reconvene and take a look at that annual goal again. Take a look at how they're educating him. What services might he need? You know, what accommodations? And that's the progress monitoring that I'm talking about. So you're collecting the data according to the goal, and you're actually taking a good look at whether the goal you're implementing is moving him from the baseline to where he needs to progress to, or is he staying stagnant or even regressing? Then you, when I, let's say the kid is not doing so great and the goal perhaps is either too aggressive or perhaps the program or the type of services they're using aren't enough, that's when we discuss whether does the child need some additional special education and related service. Oftentimes, speech and language pathologists can support reading programs for students who really struggle with language understanding, language processing language. Oftentimes, a student may also have, you know, auditory processing deficits for which they need special training to help them. There's things called like ear aerobics, E-A-R, aerobic, like aerobics, but ear to help build that child's auditory processing. And the reason why that's important is some kiddos struggle with sound symbol integration as part of their auditory processing deficit. And that struggle is specific to being able to put that set of letters together with a sound. So you and I say tri, and we know that's try. Right.
Right.
But a child who may know like words like, you know, triangle might not be able to connect TRI and those three letters, which are symbols for sounds, as that start at beginning of the word triangle. Right. So they need to be taught that sound and symbol integration, the phonemes, et cetera. There's services for that. There's programs for that. There are educational reading programs, writing programs, focusing on reading and writing, because I find that the greatest challenges for our children tend to be in that area, in reading and writing. Math, of course, right, is important. But if a child can't read or write, it's going to be very difficult for them to move forward in this world. I mean, can't even go and order, you know, a burger at McDonald's. That's a weird example for me to use, as I never eat burgers at McDonald's. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it can't even read street signs. It's very dangerous for them. So that's why I'm focusing on reading and writing right now. So like I said, there are programs out there, structured literacy for kiddos who are on the, who have dyslexia, which is neurobiological difference in a child's ability to process phonemes, to process reading. They might need related services like speech and language, like I mentioned. There's also occupational therapy for children with dysgraphia to help them with even typing, not just, you know, handwriting. Along with that, understanding the child's needs according to their disabilities, which is recorded in the present levels portion of an IEP, the PLAP or the PLOP. Then we write IEP goals that are measurable so that we can take the data on a child's progress. The progress monitoring piece is making sure that from the baseline, we're making progress towards the goal. And if not, IEP team must really reconvene to take a look at whether additional services like special education and related services are necessary. And also whether accommodations or other modifications should be done. Like a good accommodation for a kiddo with dysgraphia might be specially lined paper. If it's an issue for them to be like even words on a page, like I stated earlier, my son has a vision disability, a visual disability. So for him, he needed a lot of accommodations for that visual difference or the vision difference. And that did help him with his reading and his writing. Also, what needs to be considered is whether the student is in the least restrictive environment necessary for them to learn to read or learn to write or learn to do math or make progress in social, emotional, executive functioning, etc. If a kid really struggles to process information that's presented by a teacher orally in the front of a class. And then, you know, also dealing with 30 other kids and all the noises that students make. If they're struggling to make progress, it's not their fault. It's the environment, right? So perhaps you need to consider whether a more restrictive environment is necessary. Now, I'm not talking like private school, one-on-one in a class. No, what I'm talking about is the idea of the least restrictive environment is that to the greatest extent possible, we need to maximize a child's, you know, general education, attendance, involvement.
Right.
But if they require perhaps pull-out services to a special education resource classroom, or perhaps they need just for that subject. So, for instance, my son had most of his classes in high school were in the general education or team-taught setting. And for English, he had to be placed in a self-contained setting, a much smaller setting. Now, he was being taught grade-level English, but just at a slower pace. And the difference was, you know, now he's in a classroom of less than 10 versus a classroom of like 25, right? So it was easier for him to focus. He has ADHD, autism, a visual disability, and other physical disabilities. It's easier for him to like just feel safe and maneuver in the classroom, you know, things like that. Very important. I'm not talking about every child with special needs should be in a one-on-one setting or in a private school or anything like that. If that's what the student needs, then yes. But let's take a look at whether the environment is not restrictive enough for the child to be able to access and learn the skills that he's going to need or she's going to need in order to make progress towards higher level academics. I mean, it's one thing when we're talking about kindergarten to second grade or even third to fifth grade, that's elementary. It's one thing to be talking about that. Things change drastically when you're moving from learning to read to reading to learn, when you're learning from learning to calculate, you know, and do like simple addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. And now you have to do algebra and geometry. And it's, we have to reconsider least restrictive environment at every level, really.
Going back to the Virginia Beach situation, I want to know, like, how often do you run into situations like that where, like, the family will go to another school and the team is, you know, does it has to do with, like, the language and wording that, you know, one school is putting in the IEP versus the other, or just the lack of care?
So within the same school, you could have different combinations of teachers and staff, and the IEP that will come out of those different groupings will be different. And it's unfortunate sometimes. I have clients, any clients, let's pick a school district where I have multiple clients in one school, Fairfax County. I have multiple clients in the same school, in some of these schools. And man, I mean, there's a difference, a huge difference when you look at one kid that has a teacher who really is invested in that child's progress versus a teacher who, and you know, that teacher may be going through some difficulty in their professional or personal life. I don't know. But it's very different in approach. I'm thinking of one particular client and, or school, I'm sorry, where I have multiple clients. And I mean, not to get too into it, but I represent one family that is, you know, white and one family that is not. And the differences are stark, stark. And the time and effort put into the IEP are very different. And the response of that same school to each of those, you know, each of those two kids, very different. One, you know, basically criminalized, literally criminalized. IEP meeting with that special education teacher, and she called him a criminal. The other, same type of disability, no disciplinary referral. That kid wasn't suspended. That kid wasn't up for expulsion, you know? And that's an extreme example, but it's a recent one, okay, of the difference between IEP teams and the way that a child's education is approached, right? Mm-hmm. I've also had situations within the same school district where it's clear that they all recently had a meeting, like school-wide special education meeting, because all of the goals start to look the same for everything. Mm.
You know? Wow.
And that's when I know, hey, I got it that you guys just did. Do you know what an RFP is? It's basically like schools, just like any company, they put out there, hey, we're looking for vendors. This is what we're looking for. And a bunch of different vendors will send them contracts. So I can tell when like a school district might've gotten a Wilson, you know, like they just all bought a Wilson program and everything. Or they've just bought, you know, Raz Kids or BrainSpring or TouchMath and like, well, not TouchMath. What's that one on the computer? But that everyone's going to do it now. So all the goals start to be written to that program, right? So if this is how the program works, then IEP goals get written for every child who is being educated with that program. Let me rephrase. Structured literacy is fantastic. And if you're dyslexic, it's not just a great idea, it's a necessity, right? So there are a lot of products that claim to use Orton-Gillingham methodology. And let's, you know, I hope everyone understands it's not a product. Orton-Gillingham is not a product you can buy. It's a method. And someone who is highly trained and is a part of the Academy of Orton, it's AOGPE, Academy of Orton-Gillingham Practitioners and Educators, and someone who is a SERI certified, which is the Center for Effective Reading Instruction, SERI certified reading or structured literacy. Sometimes they're called therapists, interventionists, basically structured literacy reading teacher. Mm-hmm. That individual is highly trained and can use a variety of different purchasable programs or none to teach children to read. So sometimes a school district, when they find out, oh, we're in trouble for not teaching these kids who are dyslexic to read, they'll go out and buy something that's a program that may be based on or using Orton-Gillingham methodology, but just know you can't buy it. It's a skill. It's a method that's used by trained professionals. I mean, like Mary, you and I can like get certified for some of these programs like online, but girl, you don't want me teaching your kid to read. That's not me. No. You need someone who's specialized when the child has severe dyslexia. But, you know, going back to, you know, the question of like the IEP goals being written the same and all of that, like when I realized like the school had purchased this program and everyone was getting the same education, it was fine, except this particular student didn't need it. And it wasn't benefiting them to be placed in this special reading resource. It was actually, yeah, he had actually didn't have issues with decoding. His issues were with comprehension. But they put him in, because he had reading issues, they put him in this Orton-Gillingham product that someone had bought, the school district had bought to put the children on. It was on a computer. But he was basically wasting his time because he doesn't have issues with, you know, phonemic awareness, doesn't have issues with decoding. It's just, he doesn't understand what he's reading.
Right.
Right. And so they were wasting months with this kid and he wasn't making any progress because it was all like, it was pointless to him. Like he was not participating because he's like, I know this, you know, I know how to do this, but his issues were elsewhere. So that's just an example of how, you know, even if a school has the best of intentions and buys all these programs, but if you're not looking at the child's actual needs and you're just kind of writing an IEP to a program you're implementing, you're going to miss the mark. That school team is going to miss the mark. And of course, as parents, I mean, I'm not an educator. I'm a special education attorney, but I have got like a degree in like the Bible, you know, in like music, opera singing. Like, what's that going to do for me? Right. I don't know. We're trusting that the special educators in the IEP meeting know what they're talking about to an extent. But, you know, sometimes what parents have to do is to get outside support to either push the school team to really identify and acknowledge the kids' needs according to their disabilities or to do the school's job, especially if we're talking about a child who is getting closer and closer to high school age. I mean, I've had clients in high school who come to me, you know, they are like barely passing at any of the classes and reading at like, this one girl was at a second grade, or no, not second, I think like a fourth grade reading level in the 11th grade. Yeah. And they were constantly disciplining her for things, you know, sweet girl, but she just kind of gave up on school and education, you know, gave up on a future. And it's not that it's not that unusual. Like you do hear quite a bit of these types of outcomes when the child's needs are not identified and data is not collected towards, you know, educational progress. Yeah. So parents really need to ask for the data. If they ever make a general statement, I make it sound like it's us and them. No, we're all on the same child's team, right? Right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have to remind them, but, you know, if you're in a situation where your child's teacher says that he's doing great in reading, he's doing so well in math, and you're looking at them like, I've tried to do like 2 + 2 with my kid yesterday and it broke me. Like he could not do it. He's not doing great in math. But they make those types of statements, ask for the data, say, great, I'm glad to hear, show me the data. And unfortunately, in the situations that I'm in, like parents only bring me in when there's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. So when I go to an IEP meeting and I hear these statements, the kid's doing great. And we ask for data. And I'll even stop a meeting and say, let's pause now. You can go and grab the data and come on back. Because, I mean, you're the ones with the data, right? Shouldn't be difficult. They'll come back and lo and behold, the kid isn't doing so great. One way that grades are boosted is by retakes. And some schools have unlimited retakes. And you can imagine if you're sitting there taking the same exact test over and over again. And what's happened is in one school, the student took a test and got 50%.
Wow.
And instead of making up a new test, they gave them the same test, but he only had to do the problems he got wrong. Okay. And he got, let's say he got 50% the first time, then he got 50% of 50%. The second time. So now he's done 75% and all right. And then they give him another retake for, you know, that other, like the last 25% of questions that he did not get right. And he gets like half of those. Right. I mean, we're talking now you're inflating a grade. The student got a fail, a 50. And now you're going to report to the parents that he's got 75% or higher. And so it seems like he's doing okay. But you're giving the child the same test multiple times. You're only testing them on the problems they got wrong. Well, and Mary, I've heard that across school districts. Now, I only practice in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but I also have clients in Dodea, in Oconus. I have clients, families I work with in other states as well. And mm-hmm. I don't represent them as attorney, but I give them advice as to what the law would say about the federal law, obviously, would say about the child and their child's education. And, you know, I can tell you that this is not limited to like one school or one kid. This is, especially since COVID, this is like all of them. And so it'll seem like a student is passing when they're not actually. They're passing because you're asking them the same question multiple times. Oh, and in between, they do like remediation sessions. So they'll meet with them. I'm giving an example from, you know, my child's life and the life of other clients of mine in Virginia. And man, wow. I mean, they go over the questions that got wrong. They tell them the answers and then they give them the test.
You see my face right now.
Yeah, wow. Wow. That's why data is so important, right? It's not about just promoting grade to grade. How did that one student of mine end up an 11th grader in a very affluent school area reading at a fourth grade level? How?
That's so sad though.
You know, and she was completely checked out of school. Why? She was reading at a fourth grade level. It is. It is. And well, the craziest thing is in her record, she's a natural redhead and some teacher wrote when the parents said, I think my daughter is dyslexic and I want you guys to do some testing, the teacher wrote in their observation that the student had typical redheaded tendencies.
Yes! I'm not making this up, Mary. I can't make this stuff up.
Typical redheaded tendencies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So ask to see that data. That's how we got our hands on that form. You can request documentation through the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act. Some school districts will give you a free copy of your child's educational record. Others may charge. Others may say, and the charge is just for producing the documents, like 10 cents a page or whatever. It has to be reasonable. They can also tell you, we can't give you a copy, but you can come in and take a look at it. Great. Buy yourself a handheld scanner and get to work. You know, I have actually physically gone. I've got a portable scanner and I've gone to schools from my clients who are just so overwhelmed. And I just sat there. I was like, do you really want me to be in your building doing this? Okay. I sat there in a elementary school principal's office scanning student's entire educational file because they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't give the parent a copy. It is what it is. It's fine. The law is there. It's called the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, through which you are able to review your child's educational record. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act also talks about educational records pertaining to the IEP and the IEP process. So those should be made available to you free of charge, actually. You're supposed to get copies of your child's IEPs and evaluations and eligibility and reevaluation and triennial and MDR and all of those, FBA, BIP, all of those documents free of charge. I've had schools say, we won't charge you for the current effective IEP, but we're going to charge you for past IEPs. If they've never given you a copy, I would demand it anyway. Many school districts have moved to a online portal for parents to access all documents related to students' special education. And in that case, you know, make sure that you download and save them because I've seen documents disappear or magically reappear when we file for due process, which is litigation. They just somehow come back to life. But all is as parents, we need to be the ones really tracking this progress. Which is why the special education binder or the EFMP binder that we have created for families is so important because it gives us a framework by which we can track our child's education and progress and just be prepared to ask all the right questions. For instance, for that kiddo who's sitting in the structured literacy classes and going, why am I here? I can read. I just don't know what I'm reading. You know, that parent can be like, hey, wait a sec. This is not an area of need that was identified. Why is he in this class? You know, the kid literally sat there and wasted like months in this class. No one said anything. And had it not been for the parents, you know, demanding the data, they wouldn't have known. And, you know, part of my job is not to replace the parent, but, you know, to be their voice in meetings where, like, it's unfortunate, but let's be honest. In that meeting, you could be, you know, the foremost leading child psychiatrist or psychologist in the land, right? Or you can be, I have represented special education teachers within their own school districts, right? They don't listen to you because you're mom. They don't listen to you because you're just dad, right? But you bring me in not to speak for you, but to make sure that your voices are being heard, right? If you ever feel that your voice is not being heard, you know, make sure you're recording those IEP meetings. That's your right. State by state, it differs. Sometimes you are required to give like 24-hour notice or 48-hour notice. Some states you don't have to give any notice. Just tell them I'm recording. That's Virginia. It's because we're a single consent state when it comes to recording conversations that we're a party to. We don't have to ask permission. It's not the same in every state, so just be aware. But record your IEP meetings. That's another piece of data. So much is discussed and said. Many people forget what has been discussed and said. And another option that you have if you haven't been recording is to write everything down. To write it down, type it up, send it to all the members and be like, do you agree that this is what happened? If you don't, tell me. And if they don't say anything, like, basically your emailed summary becomes like the actual summary. So those are a few additional ways to ensure that the data that you're collecting or that you're discussing, you know, is not only preserved, but also, you know, you can point to it in future meetings and say, remember this, we already discussed this, this is what was said. Yeah. So there's a lot of case law. One of the most recent is the Endrew, E-E-N-D-R-E-W-F, Endrew F versus the Douglas County School District. And while it doesn't specifically talk about data collection, it does emphasize that an IEP has to be appropriately ambitious for the child to make progress in light of their unique circumstances, which includes their disabilities. And it does emphasize and underscores the importance of ensuring that that child is making progress by collecting and using the data to both formulate an IEP as well as verify whether or not progress is being made. There's also, let me think, what was another recent case? There was one out of the Ninth Circuit. So I live in the Fourth Circuit in the Commonwealth of Virginia. The Ninth Circuit is out in like California and Hawaii, and we're almost like worlds apart when it comes to most law, including the IDEA. But there was a case back in, it was around the same time as Endrew. So Endrew was like 2015, 2017. So I think this was probably like 2013, 2015. It was called Doug C. versus Hawaii Department of Ed. And it talked about the importance of having timely evaluations done and the impact that delaying evaluations can have on the child's education for the same reasons that we've been talking about this whole time, because data collection is so critical in identifying needs of a student with disabilities. I mean, if you don't initially identify what those needs are, it's how can you say that you're really even addressing them, right? So if you fail to identify a need, you know, you're not going to be able to tailor the IEP to meet that need. There is very little case law in terms of like case law in general. There's very little case law specific to the IDEA, but within the cases that do exist, data is, it's basically it. Like that's how you progress. That's how data is how you write an IEP. Data is how you identify a need. Data is how you measure progress on an IEP. And data is how you determine whether or not the student is receiving a free and appropriate public education. It's all about the data. And we as parents, we need to make sure that we get our hands on that data, whether it's through a FERPA, a Family Education Rights and Privacy Act request, whether it's through us just making sure that we have something like the binder that Partners in Promise has developed, so that we could keep that data with us at all times, whether it's through going into a school building and requesting to be able to view a child's educational record, as well as asking for work product. That's important. Like the example I gave earlier of the kid who is just retested on the same set of, you know, math equations and given multiple retests. So it seems like they're doing well. Well, when you look at the child's actual coursework, that's where you see, oh, maybe not. Maybe the child needs a lot more support than he's currently receiving. So all of those pieces, evaluations, IEP progress, you know, meeting those IEP goals, classwork, also the progress monitoring that's done, not just through the IDEA, but or through the IEP, but progress monitoring that's done generally for all students. That can look like baseline assessments done at the beginning of the year, which are then repeated in the middle and then at the end of year. Sometimes they're referred to as, you know, BOI assessments and MOI, EOI, beginning, middle, end of year. There's various different ways to track reading in particular. You can use a QRI, Qualitative Reading Inventory, QRI. There's the, it used to be called the, I think it's still referred to as a Scholastic Reading Inventory. But there's various different tools that are used generally, not just for special education kids, to determine whether or not they're making progress. If your child has any language processing issues, it's really important to make sure that you've identified whether or not there's also an auditory processing element that might be impacting their ability to even take in language. You could think of auditory processing disorders kind of like a learning disability in hearing. Okay. Now, I'm not an audiologist. I was told this by an audiologist, but really do parents look into that if you have concerns with your child's ability to process language and to read, because there may be more going on. It may not just be the act of reading, being able to put a sound together with that symbol and to put meaning to what they're hearing.
Thank you so much, Grace, for the invaluable information you shared with us and our listeners today regarding the importance of data collection. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining Mission Promise on this special education journey. We hope that our discussions, stories, and resources will provide valuable insights and support for you and your family. Remember, you're not alone in this. Stay connected with our community, share your experiences, and continue to advocate for your child's education. Together, we can make a difference. Until next time, take care and keep navigating with strength and resilience. This episode was sponsored by the USAA Foundation, whose mission is helping military families extend beyond the financial services and products they deliver and into the communities we call home. Thank you to the USAA Foundation.